All right, so we are on Covenant Lecture 2. My mic is having a little bit of a difficulty. All right, let's see if it stays that way. Hope I don't have to use my Bible. I wanted to put this on tape because I think, because I know what's going on in your groups, and I think this would be helpful for our away group as well. I've heard from a couple of you that you're having difficulty with figuring out the character of God. And I know that's difficult. And one of the reasons it's difficult is because we don't do it. Because we don't pay attention to God's character. This is what we do. People say, what do you think of God? God's good. And we even have a saying, right? God is good all the time, God is good. That's great. But what does that mean? God is good. Sometimes we'll say, well, God is holy. Well, what does that mean? So one of the purposes of what I'm doing with you in the groups is this needs to be a practice and habit for you to really discover who God is and what characters and attributes he is trying to display to you. And of course, it's going to be through his actions, right? He's rarely going to say to you, I am this. He will. He'll say, I am holy. But that doesn't mean anything until you see his acts, right? So one of the reasons I'm doing this for you is we need to be in the habit of recognizing, paying attention to his characteristics. When you think about people, why you're drawn to people, if someone says, why are you friends with them? You might have to stop and think about it, but you would come out with, well, they're kind to me, or they like the same things as I like, so we're kindred spirits, or whatever it might be, right? But you would be able to pick out characteristics and attributes of who they are, why you like them, why you're drawn to them. The fact that we're not able to do that with God says a couple things. It says we don't pay attention to who he is. It also says there's a possibility that your relationship with him is very, you know, and I don't want to say that, but all of us are like that. Yeah. I want us to recognize that to be in relationship with someone is to know them deeply and to actually pay attention to who they are. So that's one of the things. So yes, it is going to be difficult because we don't do it. The second thing is, what I want to happen, what I would like to see happen, is as we begin to come together and do this in a group, and I think the groups help rather than a big section here, is we begin to wrestle with it together. Like, I didn't see that. Oh, you saw that. Oh, you're pointing out something. So that we are wrestling together, helping one another. And then we come to a psalm, and we're able to say together, this is what God is like. He's like this. And the Psalms, of course, will bring out more of the attributes. Also, to pick out a psalm, trying to encapsulate one characteristic or one attribute that you've seen or think you've seen is difficult in that his characters and attributes aren't sitting here. It isn't holy here, and it isn't royal here, and it isn't perichoretic here. It's all mixed in, right? So of course so when you say, I'm not sure this is a good psalm that brings this out, yes, it is. Whatever it is. Because it's going to incorporate this intertwining of God's character and God's being. Remember, when we talk about the minds of a human being, the healthiest mind is an integrated mind, right? Which means it is, you can't separate. You can't say, well, she's only like this, on this time, and this, on this time, and this, on this time. It's all together. So in that way, when you're looking for a psalm, really, pretty much any psalm is going to work. But for you to look for a psalm actually helps you to look at the attributes that perhaps is coming through. This week might have been even more difficult, particularly because we're talking about this covenant between Jonathan and David, and we don't have God even mentioned, right? And so you're wondering, how do I do that? Unless you go back to realize both Jonathan and David are types, right? So what do you see in Jonathan and David that are supposed to point us, bring our attention to a characteristic of God? So those are kind of where I'm going with the exercise. It's not meant to be easy. It's not meant to Here's one thing I think, I hope you have noticed when I write my own stuff. I don't ask you questions that are easy. I don't ask you.
That's real.
You know what? I'm not teaching kindergarten for a reason. I taught kindergarten. I hated it. First of all, they touch you way too much. But I want to go beyond that. This is, whenever I write stuff, I don't want to ask you, where did Abraham go? What did Abraham do? I want to ask you questions that you've got to really think about and really have a conversation with God about, right? If you can just do it off the fly and not even think about it, well, there isn't any value in that. At least I don't think there's any value in that. So that's kind of where I'm going with that. I expect it to take not so much time, but thought. Conversation with God. God, what are you showing me here of yourself? And then to be able to pull that into your own life helps one another. So that's kind of where I'm going with that. I don't know if that helps, but I don't want to say I don't want you to struggle, because I do. I want you to wrestle. We grow when we wrestle, right? If Israel is named those who wrestle with God, then I think that's a fine thing to be doing, is wrestling. So I want you to wrestle with that. I'm hoping by the end of the semester, we are beginning to pay attention in our lives. Do you remember the one year we did, we went off Ann Boskamp's idea of Eucharisteo, right? Of looking at things every day, of writing down three things that you saw God giving you. That's the kind of thing that we're supposed to be doing here. Every day, paying attention to how God is showing you who he is. Every day, paying attention to that. I don't think that's something we'd normally do. Right? I don't think one of the, and I actually think that toward the end, I'll probably ask you to do this, but one of the things in liturgical circles is what's called examine. Do you know what an examine is? So examine is, at the end of your day, you examine your day, and you look, you actually say to yourself and to God together, God, where did I see you today working? What did I see you doing in my life? And every night, that's how you end the day, is you ask God, where did I see you? And what that does is you begin to recognize God in your daily life, rather than partition him off to your morning time with him or whatever you might have. So this integration of seeing God in your life, it's actually where we're going to go today. So hopefully this will help as well. But I wanted to put that before you, because I've had several people say, I'm just having a difficult time with getting this character thing. So stick with it. I think it will be a valuable lesson. I personally think it will be more valuable than knowing all the pieces of covenant, which I think are important. But I think recognizing God's character and him displaying it to you is even more important. So stick with that. So for today, we're going to talk about the practices of covenant. We're going to start in with the practice of covenant. I want to do a review quick so we always remember where we're going. The telos of covenant is?
Right relationship.
The purpose of covenant is?
Revelation.
Revelation of what?
God's character, God's desire, God's plan.
Excellent. The basis of covenant, which we really haven't specifically said it like this, but this is what it is. The basis of covenant is grace. But grace is the expression of hesed, love, and emet, vulnerability, transparency or faithfulness. They can all be translated that. So grace, when we talk about grace, we're really talking about an expression of his love and his faithfulness. You'll see that over and over with scripture that talks about his covenant, his love and his faithfulness over and over again. And that's grace. When we talk about grace, that's what we mean. That's the basis of covenant. And because of that being the basis of covenant, we can also say something like this, that everything God does is based on covenant. Everything. Everything he does. And we will look at that as how different that is in how we think about God and how the A&E people thought about their gods, because it's so close to where we think today. The movement of covenant is progressive. That's what we talked about last week. Remember, each phase of covenant builds on the previous one and then informs the next one. So that they not a single phase of covenant can be eliminated or can be dropped or can be substituted. They all require being there, working where they are, and then being built on to the next. So before we get into the full lesson, I'd like us to say together, we won't work on it today, but I'd like us to say our memory verse together. So we haven't done any of that, so it's on the front of your pamphlet. We're just going to say it together once, and then if we have time at the end of the class, we'll say it together again, and then we'll begin to work on it bit by bit. And I shouldn't say this. You know, I always say this, right? It's easy. For me, unfortunately, because this is a verse, I mean, I've been teaching this for years and years, so obviously this is a verse that I know very well. But I think it's easy, so I should not say that. So it's Deuteronomy 7:9.
Know therefore that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God, who keeps His covenant and His loving kindness to a thousand generations for those who love Him and keep His commandments.
Okay, so that's where we're going with the verse. All right. So since covenant purpose is to reveal who God is, we're going to talk about the revelation continuing with that story. I want us to always keep in mind, I'll just keep that down here. I know you can't see that, but always keep in mind that there is this progression, right? That each of the covenants are building one on the other and revealing more and more about God. The interesting thing is, a lot of times we'll take what we already know about God and we'll place it back in the Old Testament revelation. And so we will say, well, this is what it means. And although, yes, eventually it will say what it means, that's not how they saw it. That, remember, we're looking at them as little children, so we can't put that on them. It has to be small and small. Sometimes, because we've started at the end, we think of God's attributes and the revelation of who He is as something that isn't quite on par. Like, we might have the right words, but holy, for example, right? We have the right words. We say He's holy. But what do we mean by holy? Well, we don't know unless we go back to the beginning, right? So it's important that we have all these pieces together. So we're going to go back to Genesis and be reminded of what happened in Genesis 1 and 2. What was He ordering for us so that we would know Him well? And then what was lost? So we need to remember what was lost in Genesis 3. Through the inattention of Adam and Eve, right? You're going to see some interesting things. Remember that all the types for the covenant, so Noah, Abraham, Moses, etc., are going to use vocabulary that will bring you back to Genesis 1 and 2. And one of the fun, I say this only because as soon as I say Adam's inattention, and I think about God saying, did you listen to the voice of your wife instead of His voice, right? If you think about the story of Abraham, mm-hmm. He says it to Abraham too. Mm-hmm. You listen to the voice of your wife. Mm-hmm. And so you begin to see, if you know the story, Genesis 1, 2, and 3 really well, you will begin to see the vocabulary used that's picked out of Genesis 1 and 2. You wouldn't think, I mean, there aren't that many words in Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, right? Compared to the rest of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And yet, so much of it is pulled from 1, 2, and 3. So I want you to be aware of that, since we're going to look at Abraham as a second Adam or a third Adam. I want you to be aware of how the parallels come in the vocabulary. So when we look at what was lost with Adam's attention, we know that what was lost, first of all, was the recognition of who God is, right? He lost the recognition that God is holy, right? That He is perichoretic. Remember, this is holy, perichoretic. He's always giving Himself completely out for the other and always taking the other in. He's king. He is, and king incorporates creator. It incorporates rule. It incorporates able to order. It incorporates all of that. And then He is the source of life. This is where life comes from. Life cannot be brought about or sustained without Him. So that was lost when Adam turned his attention to something else instead of to God. But what was lost when he lost recognition of who God was, he also lost recognition of who he is. Because Adam is nothing without God. Without God, without being attentive to who God is, he doesn't know who he is. So he lost the idea of his recognition of himself as a son who pays attention to his father, right? Who is involved in that perichoretic life. He lost recognition of himself as a regent. And we're going to parenthesize that and say gardener. So that every time you see gardener from now on, you'll think regent. Especially, right, when Christ rises and Mary sees him and thinks he is a gardener. She's not mistaken. So these kinds of things will begin to trigger some of your the vocabulary that you're very familiar with in the New Testament. It's old vocabulary. It's vocabulary from here. And if he's lost recognition of himself as a son who pays attention and a regent, a gardener, and what was Adam the gardener supposed to do? He was supposed to keep the order of Eden. And remember, Eden is the sacred place, the sacred space where God is. It's Sabbath. It's the place where God can rule and relate without obstacle. That's Eden. That's Sabbath. That's that sacred space where his presence can rest. And if he lost the idea of that himself as a son and a regent who keeps order, who keeps Sabbath clean and ready and available for this kind of a relationship with God and humanity, where he keeps disorder at bay, right? And he takes non-order and rules it and subdues it so that it's order. That's what all that is in the word keep. And by the way, when Adam says the word, when Genesis 2 says Adam should keep the garden, all of the vocabulary in there is actually what they use for the Levites. So when they talk about the Levites' duties to the tabernacle, it's the vocabulary from Genesis 2 here. So it is a priestly duty, right? And a priest then, because he keeps the sacred place sacred, a place where God can rule and relate without obstacle, he also keeps it open. We talked about that, right? That there's one of the Adam's jobs was to make sure that other people could come and relate to God, that there were always it was always access to that. And so he lost the idea that he was a priest who gives life, who gives access to being in right relationship with God. That could only happen if Eden was being maintained, right? With order, God's order, non-order becoming order, and disorder being kept at bay. So, if he lost recognition of who God was, he also lost recognition of who he was. And in turn, that was a loss of Eden. That was a loss of Sabbath. That was a loss of sacred space where God could dwell with man in right relationship. So that it was God's presence, dwelling presence, abiding presence, that was lost, that we begin to look at what needs to be brought back onto earth. Remember that God intended to make earth a place where man would flourish in right relationship with God, that God lives on earth with man. We don't talk about that a lot, and that seems to diminish God for us, right? Because we like to think of God as heavenly, and yet his intention has always been to live on earth with us. So the loss of knowing who God was, recognizing who he was, and the loss of recognizing who Adam was led to a loss of Sabbath, of this sacred space of God's presence being abiding on earth. Now, that doesn't mean that God wasn't there, but he wasn't able to rest, right? He had no resting place where he could order without obstacle. I want you to think about a building that isn't kept up or a home that isn't kept up. In the news for the last couple times in the Naperville Sun, there's been a home kind of in the center of Naperville that's been talked about for years. Does anyone know this? Mm-hmm. It actually happens to be the mayor's son, brother. It's Doug Chirico's house that he has just let go completely. And it's in a neighborhood like this. And he's let it go for years. I think for 9 years he's been being asked by the neighbors and by the government, clean it up. Get. And finally, the city of Naperville put a fence around it, right? Because it was a hazard. It's not just
living there?
Ugly. What?
Is someone living there?
That's unclear.
Okay.
But what happened is when it isn't taken care of, it becomes uninhabitable, right? And there has to be a fence around it so that no one gets hurt in there. It's too dangerous to live in a place that isn't kept up for dwelling, right? That's what's happening with Sabbath here, right? That's exactly what happened with Eden. Is God put a fence around it and said, you haven't kept it up. You haven't paid attention to a right relationship, a place where a right relationship can happen, because you haven't kept my order. I've got to put a fence around it because it's too dangerous. It's too dangerous for you to go in. You will be hurt if you come in into God's presence and God is able to dwell there and you come in without a right relationship. Mm-hmm. So just in the last couple of weeks, they actually finally demolished this home. Mm-hmm. So it is now demolished. There's nothing there. They've taken away everything. And now something else can be built on it, right? So they had to take it away. So it got into such disrepair, they had to take it away to be able to rebuild on it. Now, what happens from there, I don't know. I'm assuming somebody will buy the land for nothing and be able to build on it. All that to say is that's a really good picture of what's happening in Genesis 3. So that we understand that God's presence no longer had a resting place, no longer had a place that he could rule and relate without obstacle on earth, right? So that the what we see of God's presence from here until we come to Abraham is God just talking to one person here, being there, but no place for him to be at home. Remember we talked about this idea of resting is being able to be God. I mean, you love your home because there you're able to be yourself, right? Fully yourself. You can just rest. It's not sleep. It's not working. It's being yourself. And that's what God didn't have once Adam didn't keep the order that God had added him to. So, sacred space is what needs to be reinstituted, right, on earth. God can't live with man unless there's sacred space. And it's not regained through Noah, right? Because we know right away, Noah and his son don't keep order. They don't keep a place. They start, right, with this mountain, and Noah starts with sacrificing, giving him worship, showing everybody God is the source of life. But then, of course, Noah acts as if he's the source of life, right, when he gives himself more and more wine. We still need sacred space to be established. So that is covenant phase one. So when you think about the Adamic covenant and the Noahic covenant, it's one phase. And we know that because of some of the wording when it talks about the covenant with Noah. It was never cut. It was established. And established means reaffirmed. So it was the same covenant phase. Okay? That's kind of where we're at as we begin to look at Abraham. We know in the first phase that what was revealed of God was that his grace is not only available, but essential for right relationship, right? It's essential for life. His grace, his love and faithfulness is essential. Man cannot live without it. We also learn that man's desire for God's presence is manifested by how?
Calling out,
right? Crying out, God, where are you? God, I want you. It's that baby cry of mom has gone and they cry. That's how we manifest our desire for God, calling out for his presence. Not calling out for his benefits, but calling out for his presence. And that's what God is going to begin to build into his people. So we now enter into the Abrahamic covenant. We have God appointing Abraham and his descendants as another Adam. And we'll see that with the vocabulary that is used for Abraham, for Abraham's story. God hasn't given up on his plan to have a listening son work with him. He's going to appoint another one, and it's going to be not just Abraham, but Abraham and his descendants. He'll covenant with a whole people, and not just an Adam, not just a Noah, but Abraham and his descendants. Some of the vocabulary that you should keep your eye out on, and there's lots, but walk, right? Because God walked in the garden and was wanting to walk with man. We'll see Abraham walk with God. And we'll nuance that a little bit, because we look at that and we think it's one thing, and we'll have to nuance that somewhat. There'll be the multiplying and the being fruitful, but it switches, and you'll see this really cool, like, wow, God is really showing himself here. We have Abraham calling on the name of God, calling on the name of Yahweh. So we'll see that Abraham begins to embody some of these listening son skills. But of course, we know that Abraham fails as well. But we'll see some more of those attributes through Abraham. One of the things you need to know in each of these phases of covenant, I guess I should put it up here. In each of these phases, one thing that you'll see is that he elects to give each the people a different status. He builds on their status. So we started here with, he's going to start here with the treasured people, but then he's going to give them a status of loyal son, a holy nation, regent, royal priesthood, etc. He's going to put on them more and more honor as he brings his covenant through. But he's also going to, so there's a new election each time. But there's also going to be each time a new kind of exile. So every single covenant actually includes this transition period of an exile. So we're going to point this out. We always think about the Exodus being the exile, and then the Exodus toward the end, or the exile end. There's actually an Exodus toward in each of those covenants. And the exiles are always for judgment, for cleansing out the space that they have defiled. So it's always for that. And you're going to see that goes along with each of those things. So before we get into the Abrahamic covenant, we need to understand some of the background so that we understand what's going on and we understand what God is doing and how he's revealing himself. It's necessary for us to know what the A&E people thought, because God uses that. And how God uses that to reveal himself is he'll say, okay, let's do exactly what the culture is doing, but I'm going to show you that I actually do it differently, or that I have different motivations in this. So he'll use that so that people have something familiar to grab onto, but then he'll flip it on them. And he'll say, yeah, but this isn't why I do it. So we're going to look at the A&E background, and then we'll see how God uses that to say, but I'm different. I'm unique. I am not like all the other gods. And he has got to begin right where they're at. We talk about that a lot. You've always got to begin where people are. And God isn't going to notice that we don't even have the idea of the Trinity, this pericritic idea, fully developed until way in the New Testament. They're not ready for that because they're children. They're babies. They're toddlers. And he's got to build them up to those things. So he's got to start where they're at. Obviously, God put all of these into being anyway, all of these ideas. And so he'll use these as a platform of learning who he is. So this is how the A&E people thought about the gods. And it was always a function of you. Remember, ancient Near Eastern people always thought in function. We think how. Like, how is it made? How is it done? We do think function, but we kind of ignore that. A&E people wanted to know, what's the purpose? How does it work? So they thought of a functional view of the gods. They saw that the deeds of the gods revealed who they were. In other words, when rain was given, they said, oh, there's a God who provides for us. So by rain, by seeing rain, They said, there's a God of rain who provides for us. When they would see a war, they would say, oh, there's a God who actually is defending us. So that God is about defending. So they begin to see things that happen in nature as attributes of God, of the gods, several gods. And mostly affiliated with natural events, like rain, like drought, like wind, like war, things like that. Those were deeds of God, of the gods, and they were providing for the people. But they also identified the gods with specific areas, so that the rain god might have been the rain god of Mesopotamia, but he wasn't the rain god of the whole world. There was they couldn't think that way, because here's why. Think about it. If he's the rain god, and it's only raining here and not raining there, he must only have power over this place, right? So that's how they saw the gods and their attributes, is they're a god who provides rain, and they don't provide it when they're mad, right? We need rain, and they're not providing it, so what's going on here? They also understood the gods to work in community. In other words, there was a whole divine council, so that all the gods worked together and were petty. So, in other words, the gods would supposedly get together and say, they didn't feed me well, so let's all of us not do our thing. So that's how they felt like they worked together. They actually saw the gods as very human. They had the same petty ideas. They had fights between them. I mean, if you any of you have ever studied Greek mythology, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly how, that was like
people.
Exactly. They were just higher people. Gods were fickle and unrevelatory. So let's pull that apart a little bit. They were fickle in that they were just like people. Like, one day they would be really kind to you, and the next day they wouldn't. They would take up offenses. And sometimes they would say, oh, that's fine. Sometimes they would love you. Sometimes they would hate you. Gods were unpredictable. Unrevelatory in that they never purposely revealed themselves. One reason was because they weren't stable enough to, right? They couldn't say, I'm holy, because I'm not always holy, right? So it's very, so for us, we can't say, well, I'm holy. Except for it being conferred on us. So the gods never revealed. And another thing is that they never had plans of their own. So the gods were never seen as, I've got this plan that I'm working out. I'm living just like a human being. From day to day, I don't know what's going on. Kind of like, so for me, a type one who has plans, you know, that go on. I never understand people who have no plans whatsoever. Like, you don't even know what you're going to do in the next hour. Like, I wake up and go, okay, here's my plan. That was how the gods were seen, as they didn't have plans, so they couldn't reveal them, right? And they didn't have a character that was consistent, so they were not revelatory gods. They didn't share with the people what they were like. But that's what everyone knew gods were like. So if we look at that, that's what the gods were like. That's how they felt the gods were like. Then we look at, well, how did they feel about humanity? How did God feel? The gods feel about humanity? As far as their value, humanity was actually an afterthought. So supposedly, the gods had been on their own, in their own little communities, and they got tired of meeting their own needs. And so they said, let's do something about that. Let's get somebody to meet our needs. Let's get someone to make sure that we have food and that we have shelter and that we have entertainment. And so they made humans. So that's the stories that you'll see throughout. So when we look at ancient Near Eastern texts, we'll read this across the board. This is how they viewed divinity, is people as gods who are a lot like human beings, and who made human beings as an afterthought, as, well, we just don't want to do this anymore for ourselves. Can't somebody feed us? Can't somebody clean our house for us? And that then they made humanity for that. So the status then that the gods gave humanity is important. So let's just back up a little bit, status. So we've talked a lot about identity. We're going to talk about identity again. But we need to split that a little bit finer. So today we're going to split identity and status a little bit finer. And status is actually how others see you. So status can be achieved, right? I've worked hard to have this status. Status can be taken, bought. But status most of the time is conferred, either by your community, by someone higher up, or in this case, by the gods. So the gods would confer a status on humanity because they made them, right? It determines what is expected of you. So when the gods conferred this, a certain status on humanity, they expected something out. It said, this is what we expect of you. So the status that was conferred on humanity was slaves. You are our slaves. This is why we made humanity. You are there to meet our needs. And that was conferred on the majority of humanity. This is how Annie thinks. This is how, and I want you to think through this, because I'm not going to go through this. As I'm talking about what most people thought about how the gods worked, there's a lot of same things we think today. Mm-hmm. And that's just been throughout human cultures. So status is often defined by extrinsic markers. So today, if you have a lot of possessions, you have a certain status, right? If you have a certain education, you have a certain status, a certain position, you have, it shows your status. And so for humanity, for most of humanity, the markers were that there were lots of temples that they were always serving at. They were supposed to be the servants of the gods. The gods did confer a nicer status on one or two people, and that would be kings. And they would confer a status to kings as their representatives, basically as their overlords. You make sure the rest of the humans get in line and serve us. So you represent us to the human beings, and you have your power over these human beings to make sure that they're serving us. And then you, in turn, worship us so that you show the people what they're supposed to be like. So when humanity thought about their own function, they thought that their function was to bring order by serving the gods, by meeting the needs of the gods, food, entertainment, shelter. This is why we have lots of temples. This is why they're bringing sacrifices. So the sacrifices in the A&E time was to feed the gods. That's the purpose. We actually still have this physically going on today, right? How many of you go to nail salons?
Yeah.
Right?
Little Buddhas.
There's little Buddhas sitting at the front of the nail salons. And what's usually around those little Buddhas?
Food. Orange or nothing.
Literally food.
Yeah.
Really?
Soup.
Soup. Cokes. I always see Cokes there. Donuts. Literally. So walk into a nail salon just this week, go to a nail salon and see. This is still an idea that to serve the gods, you were to do that. The funny thing is, it was much more intricate in the A&E times. They actually, the artisans that would make the images of gods actually were very good at it, and so much so that they made gods that were able to devour the food. Mm-hmm. So that they had mouths that opened and that you could dump the food in. So I think it's funny that, like, we are in a technological age. You could make up a really cool, Buddha.
Because someone has to then take that and give it to
them. Right. Entertainment was another thing that the gods needed, right? Which is why you have a lot of prostitution cults. In the temples. That was the entertainment for prostitution cults. So you had lots of that.
That was the entertainment, yes.
That was the entertainment. Yeah. So when you get into the New Testament and you see Paul saying some of these things that people shouldn't be doing, The reason he is doing that is because those were the symbols of a lot of the prostitution cults, a lot of the things that they did at the temples. So you see, all of this background is necessary, even when you get into the New Testament, to realize what's going on in that culture and what that really means in that culture. So then identity. Now we come to identity. So we talked about status being given to you, right, conferred as to how others see you, particularly how the gods see you. Identity, then, is how you choose to see yourself and how you want others to see you as well. And there, we're going to see some how these two are intertwined together. But identity is a choice. It determines what you're willing to do, what you're inclined to do, or what you could be persuaded to do. And it dictates what you care about, what you want, and in turn, what you will do. So, identity is defined by behavior.
So, Jill, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Identity is defined by behavior in the A&Es. It's not, when I think of identity, I think of identity.
Right.
It's not defined
so
by behavior.
It's actually the same here. But we combine status and identity.
Okay.
And that's where the problem comes, right? That's where some of the friction is, right? Yeah. Because our status and our identity don't match. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're going with that, okay? And we'll see that that's where what God is trying to bring about, right? Something that matches, mm-hmm. right? So it's true today. It's, I mean, what we talk about all the time, right? This is who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't change. And God says, this is who I've made you, what I've conferred on you, you're this.
Which is the identity in Christ part, not the...
Yeah, so yes, it's hard because of the vocabulary.
Yeah, right.
So our identity in Christ, how can we talk about it, is actually a status. But it also should be our identity
so
as well.
Blending
but it's our choice. It's our choice to match our identity with our status, which is kind of where the whole lesson will go. Okay. So the A&E people then, if their status was slaves and their identity was they chose to see themselves, then they would find meaning in actually meeting the God's needs. If their identity and their status came together, that was like copacetic, right? That worked well. And meeting God's needs didn't benefit just them, it benefited the whole community. Because think about this. If it's your turn to feed the gods and you don't feed them, what's going to happen?
The gods are going to get mad.
Mm-hmm. And they're not going to bring rain to the whole community. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot at stake for you to make sure that you met the needs of the gods. There was a lot at stake. It wasn't just your personal, but it was community as well. The gods were making sure that things were ordered so you could live, so you had to make sure that the gods were getting their needs met as well. Total transactional relationship. That's what it is. So this should sound kind of familiar. This is how we think about it. We say things like, oh, I did this, God's going to be mad at me, right? You know why I didn't get that? Because I did something else, and God's making sure that I know that that wasn't bad. So we talk about God being like this. So we haven't totally taken this away, even within the church. Meeting the God's needs required performing rituals. So the rituals were always the sacrifices to feed them, making sure that the temple was... had everything it needed, right? The housing and the entertainment. Therefore, to meet the needs of the gods, you had to live in pretty close proximity to the temple. Because it was daily needed to be done, right? You couldn't live out in the country and make sure that everybody else was doing that, right? Everybody had to live pretty close to the temples. So, and that's important for you to know as we get into Abraham's story. So everyone had to live close to the temple so that they could meet the needs of the gods, so that the gods would be nice to them, so that they could actually have food and good weather and all of the things they needed for life. And so it was this circle of, we'll meet the needs of the gods will meet our needs, and, you know, we'll be okay. It was always this kind of on edge, right? And sometimes the gods just were fickle, and they just didn't like the food you brought them, you know? So everyone kind of had to be on, like, guard, like, what did you bring them today? Are you kidding? You brought them McDonald's? They don't like McDonald's. They like Burger King. You know, that kind of a thing. So there was this idea of, we've got to do our part because all of us will suffer for it. And you will know, everyone will know who didn't feed the god today.
So, Jill, yeah. Only because I have to know this. So, is it the king, or is it, the, you know, like, who was telling them that the gods didn't like that?
The king.
The king.
Yes. Okay. So, the king was the one representation of him, right, of the gods.
Didn't they have priests, though?
They did have priests, but the priests were all about making sure that the sacrifices were right, that the everything that went on in the house, in the temple, right? Priests kept the temple. Adam's job. Same thing. So the priests weren't telling them what to do. The king was saying, the gods like this. Okay? And that's why the king was, because the king was conferred with a different status, right? So when their status and their identity were the same, they could kind of like, oh, okay, we're good, right? When the God's needs were met, so I've done my daily ritual, I've done it. Now that I'm done with my daily ritual, now I can be concerned about mine. So now my function can be about me. Now that should sound really familiar, right? I did my daily devotions today. Now I can go on with my life, right? I get my day, I get to order it how I want. I don't really have to be in attention of who God is and where he's in my life. I've met his need of me coming to him. So we do the same thing that the A&E people did. God wants to change that paradigm for us. And so this is what he uses that in Abraham's family and beyond. So we get to Genesis, and he's going to shift the paradigms. He's not going to say, don't build a temple. He's not going to say, don't have sacrifices. He's going to say, all right, let's use what we have, and I'm going to tell you how I work. It's going to look differently. So we're going to have, so here's the thing. I think Christians get really nervous about the fact that we have lots of ancient texts that look very similar to Genesis. We have lots of ancient texts that look similar to Leviticus. And people get nervous, like they don't like. I watch Christians, like they don't want to hear about that. Yeah, there's another flood story in the Shemeliad. No, I don't want. I don't know.
Worried that it discounts.
Yes. Yeah. But here's the cool thing: is it doesn't discount. It actually says God uses that and says, "Look at me. I'm different. I have something different." So every one of those stories, there's something very different about God's story in it. He uses that. Yes, there's flood stories all over the place. But in the Bible, God tells us what the purpose was.
In sacrifice stories.
In sacrifice stories. And we're going to see the difference with the sacrifice stories. So, a functional view of Yahweh. Yep, there's a functional view of Yahweh, just like there was a functional view of the gods. God's deeds done in relationship reveal him. Remember, the deeds of the gods reveal them? And they're reigning. They're bringing war. But they're never in relationship with humanity. It's always what's going on in the heavens and in transactional reactions to what man has done, not in relationship. So we'll see that God reveals himself in relationship always with humanity in the deeds he does in relationship, which is why he establishes a covenant, so that he can show his deeds and show who he is. In relationship. He also works in community. I don't want to get too deeply into this, but the people that come out of Abraham saw God work in community just like the A&E gods, that they have a divine council that they work in. And so when they read Genesis 1:28, I think it is, where God says, let us make man, they say, well, that's God's divine council, right? And for them, that's all that was being revealed there. is God works in divine counsel. We can put on it something different because we know the end of the story, but what was revealing in Genesis 1:28 is that God works in divine counsel. We know from John that divine counsel is this, right? Is himself, right? But they know that God works in community. That's important as we get on with what God is going to do with humanity. Covenant reveals him. So he is somebody who does reveal himself, right? He's a God who reveals himself because he's stable. So he reveals that he has a definite purpose, right? And his purpose is relationship with humanity. He does have plans, and he reveals those plans to humanity. Now, this doesn't seem a big deal to you, but to A&E people, this is huge. There's a God who's actually, like, we can know him, and he's going to be the same, and he's going to show us his plans, and the big deal, he's going to include humanity in his plans. That would have been so earth-shakingly radical that it would have been this, they would have just had to sit with it. What? How can a God be like that? This would have been their dream come true, to have a God that they could rely on. And that he is revealing himself. So that covenant becomes this huge thing that God says, I'm going to reveal myself to you. I'm going to reveal my desire for a relationship with you. And I'm going to reveal my plans. And I'm going to have you work with me. That was just like right there. If they would have been in a Bible study, they would have said, okay, that's all we can do for today. Because that's just so big. Yeah. So that's a huge thing. Don't overlook that. That's a big deal that God is revealing about himself, different than the gods of the A&E people. The functional view of humanity. God says in Genesis 1 and 2, no, I view humanity completely differently. They're not an afterthought. They were actually planned for and provided for. I ordered creation for the flourishing of humanity. Again, another huge paradigm shift for them. What? Creation isn't for you so that you could be served? No, creation I've made to work well for humanity. And I've planned for humanity, and I want humanity around to have a relationship with, not to be my slaves. Like, this is huge. Think about it. If you were a slave, and that's what you thought about, that your status was a slave, your identity was a slave, and someone said, I want to have a relationship with you. I mean, it's almost unthinkable. It was so big for them.
Grass Poldark?
Yeah, right, exactly, exactly.
I'm not into that show.
Poldark. Have you watched Poldark? So the beginning of Poldark, we hear this man who takes this, I don't know how far you were in. So,
yeah.
You know, who takes this woman who is nothing and actually elevates her into a great status. It's a really good show. You can
Poldark
on Masterpiece Theater. Really, really good. It's not current right now.
It's on Amazon.
Season 1, 2, and 3, right? I think.
Yeah, I don't know.
So there's.
I found it depressing. Nobody else thought it was depressing.
I love it.
I stopped watching it.
Oh.
What did I miss?
Depends on where you stopped. So status. Now we come to status then of humanity as far as God is saying, no, here's my idea. I'm going to confer a status of image bearers to all humanity for the purpose of having relationship with them. Now, a status of image bearing wasn't foreign to A&E people because that status of image bearing actually was given to a few people, to the kings. So the kings in A&E were considered image bearers of the gods. That was a conferred status. But not all humanity. All humanity were slaves. Only kings were image bearers. And when they saw kings as image bearers, then they considered kings being the sons of the gods. So you'll see this all the way through even the Greek and Roman times, right? Yeah. Caesar says he's the son of God. So when we get into to the New Testament and we begin to see the Christians saying Jesus is Lord, like that's revolution. Because, no, Caesar is Lord. When we see them saying Jesus is the Son of God, that's revolution because Caesar was the Son of God. So this is not just for ancient Near Eastern. It's also for the Greek and the Roman times as well. So God says, no, actually all humanity is image bearers. And that status is conferred through the covenants. So it's image bearing with relationship of sonship for all humanity. And again, it's just so big. Like, I can't even get into that place where I can understand how big that is. I can pretend that I think I know, but because I've never been a slave, I've never been had that status, I don't know. But for A&E people, for the Hebrews, they're just like, for Abraham, he can't even imagine what that is.
I can't believe that this, like, God was able to make this successful. That we are like, how did we get it past the A&E people?
Right.
I mean, I struggle with it now.
Yeah.
But we know the end of the story.
Right.
But that's why they struggled so much.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And we kept moving it back to the way it used, the way the God there.
Exactly.
The gods.
Yes.
All the rules. I mean, think about all of it. We kept constantly moving it back to that.
Yeah, and we'll see this over and over again. So the more background you know, the more you'll understand these stories of what's going on. So that God, oh gosh,
I
do. You know, it's funny because I actually told Bill last night, I said, I'm not excited about this lesson. There's nothing new in this. This is just,
this is probably the biggest.
I love that God always surprises me. God uses the imagery metaphor that they understood only reserved for kings. And he uses that to describe all humanity's relationship with himself. Image bearers in the A&E context were kings, right? And they were considered sons of gods. They reflected the character of the gods through their behavior. And this is where we get the idea of like father, like son. Okay, so that's the idea of the king was supposed to show in his behavior what the gods were like. Which is kind of funny, right? And if you, like, I love, most of the movies and things I love are about royalty and kings. Like, I've watched every single thing they've ever brought out about the England line from beginning to end. And it's so, I mean, it's funny when you think about, how do the kings act?
Stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Selfish.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Like
right.
Yeah.
So,
they act human,
of course. They act completely human.
Like those Greek gods.
Right, and that's exactly that we see that. But they were supposed to be the gods' representatives on earth. So that's what the kings were seen as, which is why the kings were seen as having so much power and why people would be so afraid of them. They had ultimate power. When you watch even the English kings, who is in modern history, the fact that there was a period where they could say, you just said something I don't like, off with your head.
Yeah.
And that people would carry that out?
Yeah.
You know, kind of, but again, and even in that period, kings were still considered divine, right? That they had this connection with the gods. So what we see then, as the kings as image bearers in the A&E text, we see statues being happening, right? So we have living statues, stone things, you know. we have living ones and we have static ones. The living statues are the kings, so they're considered a statue of the king, of the gods. But then we had these static ones, these actual ones that were made out of stone and expensive things. The first place you would find that kind of image of the gods would be in the temples. So that there would be an image of the god in the temple. And the image of the god in the temple always was a portrayal of some kind of a force of nature. So some way they could show either a bird, a reptile, two animals put into one, fire, those kinds of things were made into statues because that's who God was, right? The god of rain. You know, I'm trying to think of some of my Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. Think about the pictures that they made of. A lot of our symbols today in marketing are from Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. So you'll begin to see, mobile, right? Do you know what the symbol for mobile is?
Pegasus,
right? Yeah. Which was a god. So all of these things, that's the kind of thing you would see in a temple. But then, the king being a living statue, he would make statues of himself. Mm-hmm. And so he would put statues out there that looked like him, that represented the gods. So there's lots and lots of images of the gods around in the temple, and then the king, and then all of these statues around. And they would put the statues at the edge of their territory, the king's territory, so that anybody walking into their territory would know this is who's over it, this king, and he represents this god. And when they saw that, they would think two things. And these are the words they use. They use either image or likeness, which is exactly what is used in Genesis 1. When they would use likeness, they meant they were focusing on the role between the king and the god. So there's this symbiotic relationship of sonship with the god and the king, and that the king was the worshiper of the god.
Jill?
Yeah.
So it wasn't a real stretch for the people then that were in the Colosseum and they're mm-hmm. saying he's God, and Herod let him say it. And,
yep.
Yeah.
Not at all. Yeah. That was a very normal thing. Yeah, we really need to know that, right? We need to understand. Mm-hmm. And it helps us to also understand how radical the Israel community was, and then how radical Christianity was. When they used the word image, they were talking about the role of king as ruler over the slaves who he had to get to work for the gods. So image and likeness, two different things, meant the likeness was between the god and the king. The image was between man and the king and the man and humanity. And then, of course, we had all these statues. So many images of the gods. Okay, now here's one of these paradigm shifts for you. God appoints only one image bearer. And this is where we talked about in Genesis 1, which I'm not going to go through again. People are going to, you know, just have their minds flipped. God says, let us make humanity in our image. So when we translate that and we say man, it doesn't say a man, or it doesn't say each. Let's make each man images. Let us make all men in our image. Humanity corporate. So humanity corporate is one image, is the image of God. Which helps then with the idea that one act of a piece of that image bearing, one disordered act affects all. Right? God has only one image. He has only one image bearer, and that is the corporate humanity. So that here's the thing. We are not lots and lots and lots and lots of little images running around. We are together the image of God. Which, of course, is going to translate, right, even to a bigger status when we get into the New Testament, when God says the church is the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. Not little bodies of Christ, right? One body of Christ, mm-hmm. right? So all humanity, God has conferred the status of image bearer. Yeah, there's lots of implications of that, right? But just settle with that a little bit. Put it aside, think about it again. But it gives you lots of insight into what's going on. And again, God's paradigm shift for them. I only have one image bearer, which is why he keeps on bringing up more and more new Adams, right? To make sure that the image bearing all around is complete. It'll have more implications as we go into the New Testament.
That coincides with Ephesians when we're talking about the masterpiece. We are God's masterpiece. Mm-hmm. We're not each individual yes. masterpiece. We are yeah. all part of one masterpiece.
Yes, exactly.
And if one, whatever,
right,
disrupts or
a picture
does
of
not
tapestry.
Have right relationships.
Yes.
Tapestry that's
affects
made.
Right.
The whole thing.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. So, but for me, I think the biggest thing is the fact that because of what Adam and Eve did, that's why it affects me. Right? Because mm-hmm. it's because all humanity is the image bearer. So, I mean, if you're thinking about it in a statue's term, and the head got chopped off, you know, like my, oh, my angel's not out there. You know, I usually have it.
Yeah.
There's a the head is chopped off, right? There's no head on there. You know, that would make it incomplete, right? Something. And I've had people out in the yard go, well, actually, that's what happens. Usually when they're playing soccer out there, somebody goes and says, did one of our soccer balls. I want to say you have no culture. You don't even know what that is. Anyway, so God is one image bearer, and that is corporate humanity. And so all of humanity were created to, were conferred with the status of sonship, right? Of stewardship. And so those relationships of God and man, and then man and man are all, I mean, this just has so many implications of how we live, right? So many implications. So the function then of humanity, as God is telling Abraham and his descendants, is to bring order by subduing and ruling in a beneficial way, right? By representing God. We all do that with one another and with all creation. So that identity then, you find your worth in being image bearers, in right relationship with God and with others. Not in serving God so that he gets his needs met. Because God doesn't have needs. Right? This is the whole, holy means I have no needs, I'm relationship within myself, but I love relationship, so I'll pour it out and I'll bring it in. And so our identity is found in being image bearers. Now again, since identity is a choice, we can choose. Right, we can choose to be image bearers. We can choose to make sure that it coincides with our status of image bearing or not, which is what we see today, right? Everybody's saying, this is my identity, this is my identity. And what God is saying is, let's bring those together because that's the only way we'll actually be whole.
He's given every person, past, present, future, the same status.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. We don't all have the same identity because we don't all choose.
Correct. That's correct. Yeah. And then he's going to confer more and more status, and then we'll talk about that, how that affects everybody else. So now we get into the Abraham covenant. Is that enough background? you know, once you know it, you just assume it, and then you assume everybody knows that, and so you go on. And sometimes I forget. But when I learn it, I think, oh my goodness, this makes so much sense. It helps see the things so much better. And then it helps me see what's going on in Abraham's call. Right away, the very first thing, which is what we skip over when we look at the covenant with Abraham, is the fact that first, since God is going to appoint Abraham as another Adam, okay, let's try this one. Let's see if he'll be a listening son. The very first thing God does, remember, what God is going to say with Abraham is, I'm with you. I'm not against you. I'm with you. I'm actually going to help you in this role as Adam, right? And he shows it at the very first beginning, because the very first time Abram is introduced, what does God tell him to do? Genesis 12, what?
Leave.
Yeah, leave what?
Leave
his home and family. Okay. Let's go back to our A&E background. If Abraham, who is a pagan, who is an A&E people, right, he's telling him, leave the place where the temple is, right, and leave your family where there are family gods. So we didn't talk too much about that, but each family would also have had little gods that they gained to. If you ever saw Gladiator, do you remember the movie Gladiator?
Mm-hmm.
With Russell Crowe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the first time that I actually saw a teraphim. Like, oh, that's what a teraphim is. Teraphim are just little baby gods that you have in your home. They're just household gods. We're going to see those come up in Genesis. We'll see them all again. Abraham is told, leave your land and leave your family. What he's doing then is providing for him the ability to let go of the paradigms that he knows about relationship with the gods, right? He's saying, leave your country. So leave your temples, leave your gods. You can no longer sacrifice for them. You can no longer be in a transactional relationship with them. You don't live close enough. And leave your family. So leave all your family gods as well. You won't be doing that as well with them. So what he's doing is preparing Abram to receive a new kind of relationship with a new kind of God. So that idea there is so much more than, how have you usually been taught that? Abraham is told to go to a land where he doesn't know.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right? Okay. It's just basically about faith.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot more than that.
That's dangerous, because even the people that he knows that he was living with, if they know he's going to leave, they're like, whoa, you're going to, like, disrupt our gods.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We need to, like, kill you.
Right.
They probably thought he was crazy.
Yes.
He's, like, a
right.
lunatic. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
What yes.
is this other god?
Yes, exactly.
He's totally going to disrupt our gods.
Yes. And think about what Abram's thinking.
Yeah.
They're
going
to
hate me.
I'm crazy.
What? Yeah, like, what?
Gods are
you're asking me to leave the gods? How am I going to be protected?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Think about it now through Abraham's questions to God, right? He's concerned, right? How am I going to be protected? How are you going to make sure that you're going to do what you're going to do? Because I just left all my gods behind. And I just left my family gods behind. What is going to happen here? So now you begin to understand Abram's more emotional status, right? Like, this is scary. It's not just that I don't know where I'm going. You know what? They were pretty used to nomadic life.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that. It was the issue of the switch of, I'm going to show you a different way to live with the God, a different God, not in a transactional way. But he had to leave it in order to understand that, right? He couldn't be in the midst of this idea of the gods were transactional, you had to feed them, and he couldn't teach him that, right?
Mm-hmm. He's distracted, right?
Yeah.
Right, too distracted. He's got to take him out of it. So
well,
that's what's happening.
It gives you a much more appreciation for his faithfulness.
Absolutely does,
because
right?
I would be like, oh no.
Right, exactly.
I don't know how he survived and they didn't kill him. Like, people would
one of the ways is because, remember, his father dies. Right? So his father dies and then he's able to move on. Right? So there's more, obviously, there's more in the story. We can go there. We aren't asked to do look at the story of Abraham so much as the covenant.
You know, I have to chew on this a lot longer, but what I'm seeing is all what you've told me about these A&E people, it's where all our sin comes from.
Well, it's humanity, right?
Right. It's just all the things that we make God and all, you know, it's just so very interesting that it's as much as we've evolved as a
and Jesus says, you sell all your possessions, leave your family, and follow me.
Mm-hmm. And why does he say that? So now we have a better idea, right? Now we understand. What he's talking about there is, you have gods there, and if you don't leave them, you will never be able to participate in this new idea of what this kind of a relationship is that I'm talking about. But remember also, God is grace. His covenant is based on grace, faithfulness, and love. He's gonna teach us through little by little, right?
And God spoke to him. I mean, he's hearing, it's in quotes.
Right.
I mean,
that
had to be mean something.
Right, exactly. And
why else, I mean, can you imagine?
No, I mean,
God speak to you?
Yeah, have God speak to you. And you don't.
And the other gods didn't speak to them, right? The little G's didn't.
But supposedly they spoke to the kings.
Oh.
But we don't.
Right.
We don't know what that was like, right? We have no idea. So we have just enough information to know what God is doing here. He's preparing Abram for the covenant, to enter into covenant, right? He's preparing this space for him. So he's making space for Abram to be able to accept a new paradigm. So then we have, of course, we're going to go through the Abrahamic covenant lots. So we're just going to say that God cuts a covenant with Abraham and his descendants, right? So he makes a promise. Now, we're going to one more little paradigm shift here. He gives Land is a possession. So there's three things he does. He gives him land in the promise, right? He gives him land. You did this all last week. So this was, right? He gives him land, he gives them descendants, and he gives them a great name to be a blessing. So those are the three things he gives them. But we need to talk about land possession. So the land, according to how Yahweh begins to reveal, the land, all the land of the earth, belongs to Yahweh. He owns it. Possession is not the same as owning. Let me ask you, how many of you possess your house but don't own it?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What?
Having a loan.
Correct. If you have a mortgage on your house, you don't own the house. Who owns the house?
The bank.
The bank. But you possess it, right?
Yeah.
You live in it. Okay, so we need to understand that when he keeps talking about, I'm going to give you the land to possess. Not to own, but to possess. And when a God gives land to possess, and there's lots of things we can go through here, but just quickly, the purpose of possessing it is to claim space for God's presence to rest, to reside. It is claiming again a space for sacred dwelling for God. That's the whole idea behind land possession. It is not, here Israel, here's a land, do whatever you want with it. Which is what we think about, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Israel thinks about that right now.
Yeah.
So when we talk about Israel today, secular Israel, that's what they're thinking. And that's why I say, let's be careful as we talk about how we support Israel. Because we need to support them in biblical ways. And what God says about Israel, the land of Israel, is, it's mine. I own it. I want you to possess it in order to mark out a sacred space where right relationship can happen and show the world. Oh, man, that complicates things, right? We can't simply look at, it's not political land. He's not giving them political land. He's giving them spiritual land. Physical land, yes, but not political. That's exactly what he's trying to do, right? I want you to be joined in my work, to begin to set aside this land for a sacred space. So he gives them descendants then as a nation, so a people who will keep the sacred space. Same as Adam's job, right? Maintaining order and access. Order it to be a place where God's presence can rest, can rule and reign with humanity without obstacle. And they'll do so by subduing non-order and keeping disorder at bay. That was their job. So when we begin to look at Joshua and the conquest, we have to look at it completely differently than we normally look at it. And the third is to give great name as a blessing to the whole world. To give Abraham a great name so that he blesses the whole world. So that his name becomes respected and it expands the experience of God's presence to the whole world. So that others are drawn to come to the sacred space. Which of course is what we see in Revelation, right? All the nations are coming to Jerusalem. Now, interesting thing about the land, of course, the land is strategically placed, right? Israel is a very small space. It's about the size of Illinois. And yet, it actually is placed in a place where all nations had to pass through Israel in order for trade. Even though there's a lot of space off to the west of Israel, that's all desert. So people can't travel through the desert to get up to the north or to go down to Egypt. So Israel becomes the one pathway. It's the one green area that they can actually travel through. And so all trade has to pass through Israel. So all the world will have contact with Abraham's people. And so all Abraham's people have to do is keep Israel as an ordered sacred space. That's all they have to do. They're not even asked to go out. They're just asked, make this a sacred space where we relate rightly, where you honor me as holy and king, as source of life, and you behave like a listening son and a steward, a regent who stewards, and a priest who gives out life. That's all you have to do. Because everyone's coming through, I'm bringing them through, and they'll get to see you. Which now makes a lot more sense, right, about what's going on as we have Joshua, and then we have Judges, and then you understand why there is so much judgment, and then finally why they have to be exiled. So, that's the promise of the covenant. The means of the covenant is, and this is again beautiful because it goes back to Adam. So you would think that he said it to Adam, he said it to Noah, be fruitful and multiply. So you would think he's going to say that to Abraham, right? But instead of saying be fruitful and multiply, he says to Abraham, I will make you fruitful and I will multiply you. Remember what he's showing himself? I'm with you. I'm going to help you with this Adamic role. I'm going to help you be a listening son. I'm going to make you fruitful. I'm going to multiply you. And remember who he's talking to. He's talking to a man at this point, when he first says this, he's like in his late 70s. Late 70s. But a woman who's barren. In other words, their ability to reproduce is dead. It's not, there's no life there, right? There's no fertility. And God says, I will make you fruitful. I will make you fruitful. I will resurrect life within you so that life can come out. And I will multiply you. Not I will add to you sons. I will multiply your sons out of your old age. So it's God going to be there. Again, and this is where we begin to see God's character. Oh, God says, I will multiply you. I will be fruitful to you. I will make you fruitful. We see God's character of being with, right? This character of, I'm going to help you. I'm going to allow you to do what you're supposed to do because I'm going to be there doing it for you. Just this little hint, right, of what he will do for us in the New Testament. That's Genesis 17. So when we look at that, it's hard not to, just the way that her lessons go, it's hard not to, I just want to do all of Abraham. And she kind of puts in piecemeal. So we see the sacrifice. We will go through this big time many times, but the sacrifice is cutting the animals in half, a covenant ceremony, embodying the oath to keep the covenant that's legally binding. Lots in there. We'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. And then the sign of the covenant with Abraham is circumcision. And that's an opportunity for Abraham and his descendants to participate in receiving the promise. Again, we will talk about circumcision one whole lesson. All of that for the purpose of restoring his presence on earth so that he can reveal himself through relationship, right? He's not going to reveal himself from heaven. He's going to reveal himself within relationship on earth. And so he makes a people so that the people can make this land clean, a place where right relationship would happen so that he can relate to people and then show himself. And that will lead, all of that, his promise to Abraham, will lead him to establishing a people on whom he will confer a new status, and this will be the status of treasured possession. So this status, we tend to think of it as a very emotional status, right? Treasured possession. What do we think of when we hear that word?
Precious.
Yeah, precious, right? Precious. And not precious, but precious, right? It's kind of precious. Well, that term actually means something different than what we think. It's not an emotional term. It's actually a relationship of privilege and honor. It actually talks about the king's treasure by which he can get his kingdom to be great, to expand his kingdom. So it's actually talking about treasures. And what it says is, you are going to be, my treasured possession is, you're going to be seen valuable enough to be part of my divine counsel. Oh, now we go back to the idea God works in community. And now he's saying, and that community is going to be you. This people I'm making, you're going to be my divine counsel. You're going to help me in my work. And this is where the first question came when I asked you, who would you intern with under? So for me, the person that I wanted, and I've done this, I would love to intern with would be Dr. John Walton. I've talked to about some of you. That's a lot of, I think one of his books is sitting here.
Yeah.
This is a fantastic book, which a lot of this comes from. Old Testament Theology for Christians. And I was bold enough. So John Walton is who helped me a little bit on my Sabbath study. And I was bold enough, as we were talking about the Sabbath study, after we talked, he said, you know, I think I do need to write a book on Sabbath. And I immediately said, oh, I want to help you with that. Now, he never said a word. I know he was going, you're kidding me, right? But the idea of a treasure possession is, I want you to work with me. It would be like John Walton saying to me, calling me up and saying, hey, Jill, I'm writing Sabbath. You want to come and help? You want to research? And I would say, whatever. If it just means looking up all your verses for you, if that's all it means, oh my, yes. Yes, I will come. That's treasured possession. God is saying, I want you to work with me to put my plan into effect. That's treasured possession. That is this honor. My son Christian is a woodworker, and he builds and designs furniture. But he really wants to. He's always been an artist, and he really wants to do more sculpting in wood. And there was a time when he would visit all these art galleries, and he began to be enamored with one sculptor who sculpted in wood. This stuff is beautiful, known around the world. And he went to one of his shows, and he actually met him. So he was, of course, thinking, this is great. And he was bold enough to do exactly what I do with John Walton, different response. So he went to this man, and he said, I would really love to learn under you. And the man later called him back and said, yep, let's do that. And so Christian, for a year, interned under this sculptor. He didn't pay him anything. He basically worked for him, but learned all of his things. To this day, Christian feels like a treasure possession to William. So when we got to meet him, a very out there man, very artist. So he lives a lot like Christian lives, which is why Christian probably lives that way. He lives out in the middle of nowhere. He has no electricity. He does everything like, off the grid. But this man spent a year with him, teaching him and allowing him to do his work, so that some of the things Christian actually made, William sold under his name, but Christian got to be a part of that. That's treasured possession. That's this, wow, I got to be a part of that. I mean, to me, if I could work with John Walton, literally, if I could just bring him his books to be a part of writing, I mean, so he's considered, even I think on the back of this book, he's considered the leading Old Testament scholar of our generation. So, yeah, that'd be a big deal, right? Funny story. I ran into Maida when I was this week. And so she's been texting me back and forth whenever she has to speak on something. You know, of course, she wants to know all of it. And so we've been going on that. And so I've introduced her to John Walton's books. And she saw me. She said, oh, I have to tell you. I was on the Wheaton campus. I dropped my daughter off. And I'm driving. And I saw John Walton. It's so funny. I'm laughing like, yeah. And I hurried up and parked the car and I ran after him because I wanted him to sign my book. I laughed so hard. I thought it was funny. And she said, but then he went in the building and I didn't think I could follow him in. And I'm like, well, you actually could. You can go upstairs and he would be fine. But it was just funny to think that. But I get it, right? Because I've learned so many new things from him. That's treasure possession. That's what God is getting to with Abraham and his people. I want you to work with me. I want you to be part of my divine counsel. So, as we look at Abrahamic covenant, we need then to define our definition, expand our definition of covenant. So, it is a solemn binding agreement, but it's made by cutting animals in half and walking between. We'll talk a lot about that. So, when you say making a covenant, the scripture always talks about cutting a covenant. So we still have this, we have lots of different things from covenant making. We say today, let's cut a deal. That's where it comes from, cutting covenant. We're going to find lots and lots of idioms that we use come from covenant making. So cutting a covenant always involved cutting an animal in half and walking between the pieces. We'll talk about what that means, what that looks like. But it's often accompanied then by signs, sacrifices, and solemn oaths. Signs, sacrifices, and solemn oaths. So we need then to talk about what are signs, what are sacrifices, what are solemn oaths. So signs. Signs are things of permanence. And you read a whole bunch of things, right? Abram and Abimelech, they have a tree as a sign. I think Isaac and Abimelech have... So Abimelech is a title, by the way, so don't think it's the same person over and over again. They give animals, things that are of permanence, that are valuable and of permanence that will last, because signs, altars are another sign. They'll last, right? Something with stones. If you walk in the woods, a lot of times you'll see what are, I don't know what they call them, cairns, yeah. Stones upon stones upon stones, right? It will last. Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S. they're used as a witness, as a mutual witness for both parties of a covenant to see, to tell the reality of the binding agreement. Their purpose is to mark, their purpose in the covenant with Yahweh is to mark out or call attention to God's presence. So what you'll see Abraham doing, God has promised him the land, and the first time he steps foot into the land, he builds an altar as a sign. Oh, I'm marking out God's presence is here. He's said that this is our land to possess. Here's his. And he goes on and he builds another altar on the mountain there, right? Always the place of the divine. So he marks out, he calls attention to God's presence here. In fact, we have Jacob, right? When Jacob has his dream, remember? And he realizes that God's here and he says, God's here and I didn't even know it. And so he builds an altar at Bethel, right? House of God. So we see this idea of signs being a way to mark out or call attention to God's presence. Because we're not aware, just like Jacob. Oh, I didn't know God was here. Mark a presence. So that every time I see this, this is why it's permanent. Every time I see this, I remember that God is here. God is present. This is God's land here. Sacrifices. Sacrifices are the giving of blood, the offerings on the altar, right? The giving of life, I should say, which is seen in blood. But it's also in receiving of life, and that's meals. So you're going to see a lot of meals in covenant. It's why we have, in many customs, why we have a meal after a wedding. Since a wedding is a covenant, we have a meal, right? That's a sign of not just giving life. They already gave their lives to one another, and now they receive the life, right? They actually eat together. So eating is always a big deal in the Middle Eastern culture, and meals were considered a receiving of the other's life. Because for me to feed you in the Middle East, that meant I was giving you, like, my food, which was not...
In most other countries besides the Western.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. Yes. So giving you a meal, I mean, when I think about... the families that took care of both my kids when they were in Syria, I will cry when I think about what they gave to them. When they like Lissa's next door neighbors who were refugees themselves from Iraq, they would give her meals, and I would think, you're a refugee. You don't have much and you're giving, so that's really giving life, right? Mm-hmm. And for Lissa, of course, in Middle Eastern things, you receive that, right? Because you know they're giving you their life for you to say, no thanks, I don't like that. You know, that would be very offensive. So sacrifices are giving and receiving of life. The purpose of sacrifices for Yahweh, so Yahweh's changing the paradigm, right? What was the purpose of sacrifice in the A&E cultures?
To feed the gods,
right? To meet their needs. Sacrifice for God, for Yahweh, is to make space for him, for his presence, right? To make room, to clean out the place of his presence. We'll talk about sacrifice more, and to participate in God's presence. So it's to clean out, to make room, to say, here, I'm giving you my life, and I'm going to eat what you've given me. So there's always, in the big holidays, the big festivals, the sacrifices, remember, the sacrifices got eaten, right? Some of it got burned, most of it got eaten by the priests, right? And then there's a few times when the whole community eats there. So sacrifices are to make room for God's presence, to clean out that space, right? And then to participate in God's presence. All of these then have these parallels of where, what they're doing going into Israel and making a clean space for him. And then solemn oaths are promises, blessings of a shared life, and ceremonies that embody those promises. And the purpose of solemn oaths, the ceremony that we see with Abraham, is a public declaration of desire for God's presence. In other words, I want my identity to match my status. I want the status of image bearer. I want that to be my identity. I'm declaring that I want God's presence here. I can't be an image bearer without his presence here. So that the reasons for such customs are to bring attention to the value of God's presence. And by the way, all of these apply to the same thing when we have lots of different sacrifices and things, signs. We have a lot of signs when we celebrate things. When we celebrate anniversaries. We have the ring as a sign of the marriage covenant, right? It's to bring attention to the presence of that other person. In this instance, God's presence. Right? I wear a ring so that people know that I am married to Bill, right? Mm-hmm. That's not mine, this one. I wear that so people know, right? When husbands and wives don't wear a ring, that's tough, right? Because what are you saying there? I don't want to point out the fact. Mm-hmm. Now, my son often doesn't wear his wedding ring, and he's set. I mean, he's a woodworker.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of dangerous to wear a ring when you're using all these tools. But again, it's a sign to point out the attention of the other, right? I'm in covenant with another. It's also to keep us accountable, to remind us to live in such a way as to maintain that presence, right? Like, oh, a ring. Oh, I'm married. I can't be... That's what I'm thinking about. I can't be flirting with another man, right? I'm married. This keeps me accountable, right? If I'm wearing it, and I've seen people, slip their rings off, right? Don't have that accountability. And to affirm the priority of presence, to affirm the joy I get out of his presence, right? And if you look at those three things, to bring attention to the value of God's presence, to keep us accountable, to live in such a way as to maintain his presence, and to affirm the priority of presence, those are all the psychological attachment places, right? Attention, attachment, and joy. So not surprising. That's how God has wired our bodies. Now we get to robes. Wow, 10 minutes. Go through the robes. I think she was pretty thorough in your homework, so I think this can go really fast. You understand that one of the covenant practices was to exchange robes. And robes, it's symbolic, right? So all of these practices are symbolic. Why? Because we're visual people. God knows how he's made us. Those are ways we can understand, and they help us to remember. So in the exchange of gifts, the first one being robe, next week we'll talk about two other gifts, it's a twofold process, right? It's always a surrender, a stripping off, and then a putting on. So we go back to Abram, and what does God do? He helps him strip off, right? His identity of being in relationship with a transactional God. He helps him strip off by taking him away from there, right? Taking his whole identity away. He has him strip it off by leaving him. Because you can't have a new land and a new family and a new God if you still have the old. There can't be dual citizenship, is what God is saying. That's impossible. Because where's the loyalty, right? And the New Testament says this over and over again. And that's what happens when your identity and your status don't match. Is there's this dual, right? Like, where is my loyalty coming from? This is what God is trying to bring it together. But it requires this vulnerability of taking off. Like you said, now you understand Abram's fear. Like, what am I going to do? How am I going to be protected? If you play musical chairs, I hate musical chairs. I've always hated musical chairs because there's this idea, this vulnerability, right? Like, I'm going to be left out. I'm going to not have what I need. I'm not going to have a place to, and everyone will see it, right? But it's required because I can't give up my chair in order to get a new chair. I mean, I have to give it up. I can't have it on. I think one of, and I've used this illustration so many times, and some of you have seen it a million times, but I think it's probably the most vivid. When we talk about our identity, as us choosing our identity, and we think about, you know, I don't know, my identity is a teacher. But it's never as simple as that, right? It's never a teacher. It's a good teacher, right? It's not just a teacher. So whatever you consider your identity to be is what people recognize, right? Because that's the way you behave, and it's kind of what you talk about, and it's pretty much how you want people to see you, right? And so a lot of times we have very identifiable things. I used to always talk about whenever I'm in the grocery store, I know I can see Karen Johnson from miles away because she wore the same coat for years. The first time I said that in public, the next day she went and bought a new coat. But it was identifiable, right? She had a green coat. I knew it. Like, I didn't have to see anything but that green coat, and I knew that it was Karen. So we have these identifiable things to say this is who we are. For a long time, I used to wear a coat that was not mine, but I wore it all the time, so I was identified by it. So it was Liz's coat, and so I used to wear this all the time because it's perfect. It's really light, and it's big, but it's really warm. So, but it says, first of all, it says Naperville Central.
Gymnastics.
So I would wear this around. And I literally got people that come up to me and said, first of all, before they would see my face, they would say, oh, are you in gymnastics? And then as soon as they see my face, they go, oh, are you a coach? And this was a long time ago. But obviously, if I'm wearing this, people say, you're identifying yourself with Naperville Central gymnastics team, right? Somehow you're affiliated with that. You're wearing that around. It's why we have, what are these called?
Letter jackets,
yeah. That's why we have them, right? We want to identify ourselves with a certain sport, a certain school, and here's the funny thing. Sometimes we'll wear letterman jackets that really have nothing to do with us, like a Bears jacket, right? Mm-hmm. Or a Cubs jacket. I wear those because I want to identify myself with them. I have nothing to do with that team. Absolutely nothing. But I want to be identified with that, right? So that's my identity. But what God is saying and what covenant says is, I'm giving you a new identity. Really, I'm giving you a new status. I'm going to confer a status on you. And so he says, I'm going to give you my robe. I'm going to give you how people will see me and identify me. And so he gives us this. And this is our tendency. He gives us some beautiful big white coat, right? And so this is what our tendency to do is do this. And we love it, right? And so we say, you know, I belong to God. I'm his child. I'm his treasured possession. And this is all great. And even, I can't even take it for 2 seconds. Because what's happening right now?
It's so hot.
Hot and really constricting. It is so constricting. So what eventually will happen is, I can't do this anymore, right? Like,
because you're safe. You got that other one.
I got the other one still. So I'm taking this off. So I take this off more often than not, right? Because I still have this. The exchange of robes says, before I give you this new status, you've got to get rid of your identity, right? You've got to get rid of it. We can't have both. They've got to match. And when they match, you only need one. So I've got to take this off.
And it's comfortable.
Right. Exactly. It's comfortable, right? And that's what we always say, right? If you ever watched What Not to Wear. That was what people always said. But it's comfortable. And that's what we always say about our identity. Because we chose it. It's comfortable. But in the exchange of robes, what we see with Jonathan and David is a taking off. So Jonathan takes off his robe and he gives it. Which is what we see with Christ, right? And so we take off our identity and we allow our identity and our status to be the same. And now, I actually love this coat, even though it's completely out of style now. When I first started using this, Like, this was really stylish. Obviously, not so stylish anymore. I almost got rid of it. I actually had it in the Goodwill pile, and somebody saw it and said, "You can't get rid of that. That's your prop. You need that prop." So I keep it. Oh, I have gloves in here.
That's working, guys. Still providing.
This is the idea that's happening with Jonathan and David, is this idea of surrendering your identity and taking on the status God has given you. In Jonathan David's case, David is being given a royal status, right? Because Jonathan's giving him his status, and Jonathan's taking his off. And so we have this picture. I think you know the scene well enough. If you've done your homework. So what that meant, though, for Jonathan in taking off his robe, is that he had to turn away from his father in order to do that. He had to give up his relationship with his father as being the most important. So what we're going to see in covenant relationship is a priority over all other relationships. And that's really important, right? And that's what we see with Jonathan and David, is the covenant relationship between him and David is more important than the covenant, than the familial relationship between Jonathan and Saul. So that Jonathan is now bound himself to David and says, "I am bound to you. I'm bound to protect you and see you as a king. And see you as my king." So it meant not only giving up a priority relationship with his father, it also meant giving up his own ambition, right? Once he gave that to David, it was saying, "I will see you as king. I will honor you as king. I will be your subject. And David, you will be king." So it was a huge thing for Jonathan to do. It's a huge thing. And we need to know how huge it is for Jonathan to do that, because when we get, of course, to Philippians 2, and Christ does that, we need to understand what he's doing there as well. So, robes really give us the idea of status and identity together. So what God wants us to do is say, "I want your identity and your status to match, to come together. So you only need my status that I'm giving you. Image bearer, but again, treasured possession," and we'll see more and more as we get there. One of the signs that we have, one of the ceremonies that we go through that does this for us, is baptism. And baptism, because of the words that are used are to dip as in die. So that when we are dipped in baptism, now, no matter which way you do it, the idea is when you come out of there, you have a brand new status. It's like taking a white cloth, and this is why they use this word, taking a white cloth and putting in a purple dye and coming out. That white cloth will always now be purple, not white.
Brand new status or brand new identity?
So both.
Okay.
So status, because it's given to you, right? Identity, because you want it to be the same, right? So again, identity is the choice. So here's the problem that we have, right? God says, "I want to give you a new status. I want to give you image bearing first as a status, but now treasure possession, and then more. You get to choose, is your identity going to be the same? If it's not, I'm wearing both coats. But I get to choose that, right? So God's saying, I want you to have a whole life, a life that's not constricting. I want freedom for you. And freedom is actually having your identity match your status. So you only have to wear one coat. It's not freedom for you to be wearing both a different identity than your status. That's not freedom, that's constriction. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Weren't we born with that status? Like, made?
We were born, we were conferred, given the status of image bearing.
Yeah.
But we have more statuses, right? Treasured possession is one. And we're going to have more and more, right? And we're going to have more as we go into the new covenant. You'll see more and more, right? But yes, so our status as image bearers. I mean, we got to start with there, right? If my identity is not image bearing, I am wearing two coats, and it's going to be constrictive, and it's going to be hot, and you're going to throw that off so fast, so many times a day, right? So this idea, when Colossians talks about put off, all of these things and put on. He doesn't ever just say, put on the Lord Jesus Christ. He always says, put off. And it's not because he wants you to be not have freedom. It's because he wants you to have freedom. He wants you to be able to have this really nice coat on without feeling it. I'm going to stop here with robes because I want to do one more thing before we leave. Next week is Lent. I know a lot of you don't follow the calendar, the church calendar, but I think it's important as we begin to understand that the church calendar is one of those signs and ceremonies that help us. I want you to begin thinking about Lent for next semester or for next week. I want you to think about your identity and your status. And if there's anything about your identity that doesn't match up with your status, that maybe needs to be taken off, that needs to be gotten rid of, that needs to be left behind, like Abram left his land and his family. I want you to go to prayer about this. I want you to really ask God what perhaps is it. What I don't want you to do is say, oh, I'm going to give something up for Lent. And here's what's the most common thing everybody gives up for Lent?
Food.
Some kind of food.
Chocolate,
sugar, chocolate. Yeah. I mean, it's right off there. That's not what Lent's about. Lent's about taking something off that isn't your status that God's given you and keeping it off. So it's not a 40-day exercise in restraint. It's actually a follow the covenant idea of taking off an identity that doesn't match, or some part of your identity that doesn't match your status. You're going to have several weeks of thinking about this, because next week we're going to talk about the way you defend yourself and the way you keep strong. It might be some of those things, but I think identity is a good place to start. What kind of an activity do you do? And here's a possibility. When I've been asking God, what is it that you would like me to give up because it's not the same as my status? As soon as I heard, I was like, oh, not that. Then you're probably right on target, right? Because it means you've held on to it as something that you want other people to see you as you want to be seen as, that isn't a treasured possession, that isn't image bearer. And it may be just an activity for that identity. I want you to explore it with God. And so we'll talk next week about perhaps some things that we are willing to let go, to leave behind, so that we can put on fully, so that we aren't so uncomfortable with this beautiful status that God has given us. Anybody have any questions on that? Father, thank you for this day, for all that you have taught us. Thank you, Lord, that you are a patient God who teaches us as children and gives us little by little. But also sometimes, Lord, we feel that you've given us way too much. I pray for each of us today that this week we would first of all recognize you. We'd recognize your presence. We'd mark out your presence. We'd declare our desire for your presence, and that we would recognize over and over again your holiness, your withness, that you are helping us with this, that you aren't you're not saying go and do this without being with us in it. May we be so aware of your presence this week. In Jesus' name, amen.